Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello, and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of The Oldie, and I'm delighted to be talking to Jeremy King, the greatest restaurateur of the age. He has owned and run the Caprice, the Ivy, Sheikies, the Woolsey, the Lawney, Arlington, the Park, and he's about to embark on Simpsons, the famous restaurant. And he's written a terrific book, Without Reservation, Lessons from a Life in Restaurants. Now, as I said, Jeremy, you're about to embark on Simpsons in the Strand. I won't say how old you are, but you've been around for a while and you still want to run a huge restaurant. Do you think you're addicted to running restaurants?
A lot of people say that, and thank you for that kind introduction, a lot of people say that I'm very brave to do it, but I often think that bravery is misunderstood, because if you go into something, if a soldier storms a pillbox knowing that there's a good chance they're going to die, that's brave. But if you feel that you have no option but to do it, and that's the way I feel, is that I just want to do it. And one of the things about the book, I talk about the difference between doing things because we want to do it and whether we should. And if you want to do something, nothing stops you.
And you're so good in the book about what it's like running a restaurant. It seems to me you've got an astonishing attention to detail, which is crucial, isn't it?
I think it is important, and I think one of the big enemies of restaurateuring is complacency and a sense and arrogance and a sense that you've got it wrong. I'm fascinated when I read interviews in the paper with people who say, "Do you regret anything?" And they say, "No." Well, the sort of captains of industry, etc. Every day I regret something. Every day I think I could have done something better, and that drives me on. Detail's part of it. But it's also because I am inherently an observer. I'm quite shy, and so I like looking. So I might see things. So detail is part of my makeup.
And you pass this on to your staff, who are extremely well-trained. One of the things you say in the book is you tell them, don't ask a question unless you need an answer. So Don't come up and say, are you enjoying your meal? What are the main crucial things you teach your staff?
To smile, funnily enough. I think I was having a meeting yesterday and we were talking about customer service, and I was saying, who of us doesn't want to be loved? Who couldn't do with a bit more love in our life? Who couldn't not want to feel more welcome? And who doesn't enjoy generosity? And I think it's something which people overcome, because society now is so transactional, and words like altruism are completely becoming extinct. That's, for me, is the most thing with the staff. It's a smile. Make people feel good. Make people feel welcome. I was jokingly, I was saying, you know, we're going to do a coat of arms, and we'll put into it the Latin. Our Latin coat of arms will say "Amor et generositas," love and generosity, which to me is what a restaurateur needs to be supplying. Yes, there needs to be food and efficiencies and all that sort of thing, but in a way they're the easiest bit.
And actually you say that although the food in your restaurants is always extremely good, people prefer a place with so-so food and excellent service to wonderful food and terrible service.
Absolutely, and if we aspire to make them both fantastic. But it is complacency. I think I talk in the book about asking a group of managers after the Woolsey had won Restaurateur of the Year, how are we going to win that next year? And then somebody says, they fall into the trap and say, by maintaining our standards. And then, no, that's the route to bankruptcy. And in all walks of life, whatever we do, we must never aim to maintain our standards. We always have to be trying to get better.
And you're very good on tricky customers. And there's a brilliant bit which combines tricky customers with dress codes that you say the tricky customers are always in suits and ties. Is that right?
Well, it's the whole thing about I don't understand dress code. I really don't understand. I mean, I think the best dress code is actually Glyndebourne, which is often quoted to me. People say, well, they have a dress code there. Why can't you make a dress code in the restaurant? I said, there is no dress code at Glyndebourne. It's peer pressure. It's respect. It's all those different things. And I don't understand it because in all my 50 years, 90% of the problems I've had with customers, serious problems, have been with people wearing suits and ties. So I don't understand dress code. I think behavior code is something I'm very keen on.
And you've had quite a lot of confrontations. You've had a beer stein thrown at you, is that right?
You absolutely.
And you'd have a brilliant tell when someone's about to punch you. What is that?
Yes, it's a very male thing. I don't know whether it applies to women as well, but men can't look you in the eye and punch you. They look down first. So if anybody ever see, if you're in confrontation and your your assailant or your adversary looks down, be ready to move sideways. But of course, the whole thing about confrontation is that when somebody shouts at you, you go quiet. When somebody threatens you, you just ask a question back. And there's all these different ways of dealing with life. And that's the beauty of the restaurant business, is that because I've spent so much of my life in there, I've learned quite a lot of these things.
And there are brilliant techniques with tricky, aggressive, show off, always males, feed them quickly. Is that right?
Yes. It's. I think you're alluding. There used to be a time in the 80s, if we had a surprise, a table of six, and we didn't know the people, salvation was when a woman walked through the door with the men, because that would always bring decorum. Unfortunately, late 80s and into the 90s, we saw this change, and particularly driven by the city, where women started to ape the behavior of men and be more laddish than the men themselves. So it's very difficult to determine that. So if we get a group and there is a moment, is they're wearing the suits and ties, the moment the jacket comes off, the coat comes off, the sleeves are rolled up two times up the forearm, the tie is loosened, then you have problems. And the aspect of that which is so important is that one loud table can destroy a whole restaurant, and because it then it escalates throughout the restaurant because people are competing to talk with each other. And then there are lots of ways of dealing with that. As you say, feed quickly, be over attentive. I think I write about that. If you find that the service is over attentive, then you may be badly behaving, because just as that anecdote has been told and get to the point, interrupting the punchline is never a bad thing.
And very interesting, someone's being tricky about the food, send the chef over.
Yes, chefs didn't like it at first, but then they understood. You put a, particularly if they're wearing a toque, the high white hat, and they come to the table, it's very disarming. If I go to the table even, let alone managers or whatever, there's a frustration. But if the chef comes, and I think the important element of this is that it's the introduction of humanity, because it's difficult if somebody's come up and said, I'm really sorry that you didn't enjoy that, I'm really sorry it wasn't right, then people tend to actually understand the humanity of the situation and somewhat melt.
And to go back to the course of your dazzling career, your first very famous restaurant was the Caprice, which actually to begin with was quite tricky. Is that right? It wasn't an immediate hit.
No, we opened a particularly difficult time, September 81. There was a freezing winter, which the whole city ground to a halt, and we had a backer who was frustrated because we were fighting, because their idea of a restaurant and our idea of a restaurant differed. I'm somebody who's always very low-key, understated. I narrowcast rather than broadcast. We have to be patient on restaurants. And we had a big big falling out. It actually closed the restaurant January the 8th, 82, and had to come back. In fact, Chris wanted to abandon the whole project, thought it was doomed, and I managed to persuade him to do it. And it was hard for months. I've stood in that restaurant 10 o'clock at night with nobody there. But we were saved by the theatrical fraternity and the artist fraternity. So there was a whole load of those artists who were made really famous. They all became academicians and would come across the Peter Blake, Alan Jones, Patrick Caulfield, Michael Craig Martin, that generation, Howard Hodgkin and so on. And then because of the connection at Joe Allen as very much a theatrical restaurant, that group of people made it as well. There was one, forgive me, I'll tell the story, when we were really struggling, we were doing about 30 covers a night, a phone call came through, and on the other end was Marie Helvin, and Chris took the call, and she was saying...
It's Chris Corbin, your business partner.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely, and who was then my business partner, we opened it together, and he said, Marie Helvin on the phone, and she's just said she's with Mick and Bianca and Anthony, now this is Anthony Price, Mick Jagger, Bianca Jagger, then Brian Ferry, and so it went on, and they want to come for 10, and this evening, and they say, will you be busy? What shall I say? I said, we're going to be busy. And we pulled friends out of bed or all sorts of things or out of other, and what the theatre would call papered the room. But of course, the bona fide guests and even our friends who we pulled in were so blown away. And this was in a day when, of course, restaurants thrived on word of mouth as opposed to social media. And it made an immediate difference. And the theatre people were particularly useful because... we were known for staying open late, which was unusual, and we would then have an interesting clientele. And in a way, that's what I really want to maximize at Simpsons, because this is a place which has a very late license, and we have a particular bar which we're aiming at the theatrical fraternity, both practitioners and goers. So the idea that you can go late, have fun, and not have to pay a lot of money, not have to pay a club subscription or anything like that. And I think the more that restaurants are not seen to be these sort of gilded ivory towers and actually are welcoming to people, because the most interesting people normally in a restaurant of any evening are not the richest people. They're often the least affluent. But they're the most creative, and that's the melange which actually makes a difference.
And everybody might want a glimpse of a star, and you had the greatest star of all, Princess Diana, as a very regular diner at the Caprice, and you're very good about the difficulties of getting her in and out and where she should sit.
Yes, and to make her feel comfortable, because there are enough restaurants who would get... whose managers would be more like Uriah Heep coming over to the table. She wanted as much as possible, and it's not affected in the way that some celebrities say, I don't want any attention. They want the attention, but she didn't. She wanted to be safe, and I think safety is an important element of all our experience. And so we learned how to look after her, and it was actually. In fact, rejected her coming initially because the famous famous bodyguard Ken wouldn't tell us who he was preparing to come. So I said, "Then they're not coming because unless we know, you've got to trust us." And Ken Wharf was the guy, and then he did, and so she started coming, and she could go anywhere, of course. But she just wanted the reassurance that she would be left alone. What was terrible was after she gave up her security. People would hound her down the street, etc. She tried to live a normal life. And it was a very sad passage in time, which, of course, in the book, I do talk about the funeral, which I found very poignant for the wrong reasons.
Because security were very good about getting her out of the restaurant. I think there's an underground car park.
We would either take them out that way. And this was, interestingly, you don't see it to the same degree now, but in the 80s and even into the 90s, for instance, at the Ivy, you could have as many as 20 paparazzi outside a restaurant and waiting to come, and I had to control them. It was a fun standoff, because the way I would do it is I bought high voltage torches, and I would say to the paparazzi, if you don't behave yourself, if you don't show respect, the torches come on. Because what would happen is that as somebody would leave, we'd be behind them with the torches, which would ruin the photographs. So we had a mutual respect.
And occasionally a hose, wasn't there as well?
I would suddenly decide that plants needed watering, etc., and so on. It's you've read assiduously. Uh-huh. Thank you.
And a figure who crops up a lot, a great friend of yours, who I knew as well, Harold Pinter, who came to many of your restaurants. And you're astonishingly kind, I think, when he cast you as a character in his play. Can you explain what happened there?
Yeah, I was... try and condense. I was at a dinner for Ed Victor. It was his birthday, and we were at Ruthie Rogers' house, and sitting opposite Harold, and Harold looked at Ruthie and myself together, and he said, I've written a play. And I cheekily said, as you do. And he said, it's set in a restaurant. I go, oh, great, tell us more. No. And it was only when a few months later, I was in Caprice, as it was at the time, and Alan Yentob and Eric Fellner and somebody else came in, and I went to the table, and they started laughing at me and pointing at me, and they'd been to the preview of this play called Celebration at the Almeida, and I said, what's happening? And they said, Harold's adopted your mannerisms for the restaurateur in this play, because it's set in a restaurant. And I had this whole conversation with him, because I went over to the Ivy afterwards, where he was after a preview that they'd been to. And he said, oh, Jeremy, I wanted to talk to you. I said, yes. He said, listen, I've written a play. I said, yes, I know, we talked about it previously. Yeah, it's on at the Almeida. And I said, yes, I'm going to be there on the opening night. And he perceptibly winced. And he said, I wouldn't want you to think that this play is based on any real restaurant. I said, no, of course not. And I wouldn't want you to think that any of the characters are based on anybody in real life. I said, no, of course not. That'd be terribly unprofessional, wouldn't it? And he sort of winced again. And good, we've got that straight then. And of course, I turn up at the Almeida on the opening night, and it was Hilt McRae, who was married to Lindsay Duncan, who was in the play, said, Jeremy, do yourself a favor, turn around, go home. And the play, this man came out on stage, the restaurateur, with all my mannerisms and so on. And I was upset. And I refused when Harold was ill, they then put it on as a rehearsed reading, and I didn't want to go, and then Nick Allop persuaded me to go. And it was completely different, and Antonia Fraser was there, and it was Charles Dance playing my character in a completely different way, in a sort of rather haughty, supercilious way.
Not using your characteristics.
No, and actually the play was better for it. And the good thing about it, and I always think there has to be good things even in adversity, was that Harold realized he'd done wrong, and he came as close to an apology as that you will ever
encounter. Very, very rare, yeah.
Very, very rare. And I was approached by Susanna Gross, sadly no longer with us, who this extremely good bridge player. She said, do you play bridge, don't you, Jeremy? I said, I haven't since I was a teenager. She said, would you like to? And I said, yeah. She said, with Harold and Antonia. I said, really? And of course, it was a setup to, and what happened, I was left in the room with Harold so he could do his apology. And then the beauty of that is then he, from there on, he was a friend.
Did he use the word sorry?
No. Oh, actually, I think he said, well, on the basis, I am sorry if people thought that...
The conditional apology.
It's a conditional apology, yeah.
And you're very honest, too, about with these great successes. You have had your failures with restaurants. There's one called Alban, is that correct?
St. Alban. Yes.
And you can see in retrospect why one doesn't work, is that right?
Oh, yes. In fact, in truth, I tend to know before. And something else which comes up in the book is that one of my big regrets is that I haven't always used my instinct and intuition as much as I should. And I knew that we were doing a should rather than a want, because Chris and I were desperate to find another restaurant, and it had a lot of elements. But in life, if there's no absolute vision, and I tend to normally have a clear, unequivocal vision of what a restaurant should be, you end up designing a restaurant as a committee. And there's a wonderful old saying, which is, a camel is a horse designed by a committee. And there's a lot to commend a camel. It's cheap to run, very reliable, long enduring. But when you want a horse, you kind of know. And I think we all need to be more honest in our lives and confront failure.
So, for example, what was wrong with St. Alban?
I mean, there's very specifics of it, is that through a certain amount of hubris, we didn't want to do effectively another restaurant with fish cakes and so on, and we're doing a much more American restaurant. And part of it is, I always react to the building as opposed to the market, so to speak. And we were creating quite an American feel to it, and decided not to have a bar, which was a mistake. And we decided, and we left it too big. We should have put some more private rooms in and so on. So it didn't have that critical mass. And there were various things. Ironically, and there are so many people to this day, even though it closed, 15 years ago, who still say that was my favorite. That was my favorite. The cooking was as good as we'd ever done. There was a lot of the elements were brilliant. We didn't quite have the design right. We didn't quite have the lighting right. We had Michael Craig Martin and Damien Hirst right at the peak of their popularity and importance doing the interiors, but it just wasn't right. And by analogy, it's I think in life, it's as with a tailor. If a suit doesn't work on the first couple of fittings, give up on it, because otherwise that suit will stay in the closet forever.
And you're also very honest about what must have been very upsetting, the takeover of your whole restaurant group by, is it called the Minor Group?
Minor Group, yeah.
And they behaved, seems to me, extremely badly, kicking out of your office, taking everything away from you. It must have been very upsetting, but again, you seem to be extraordinarily good at absorbing blows like that. What was it like at the time?
It was traumatic at the time, but I took so much out of that. And before we had this option effectively for it, and I knew I was probably going to lose it, and I said to a confidant, you know, I might lose it, and it may not be a bad thing, because I was going to go into business with the people who were going to buy it on my behalf, were prepared to spend a lot of money. I thought, I'm going to be indebted to them, and I'll effectively be working for them for the rest of my life. I want to be independent. I'm no good at working for people. I like having investors, but I don't want to work for anybody. And we have to recognize what our strengths are. And so when it happened, And I pulled out of the auction. My backers wanted to carry on. I said no for that very reason. And it's my trait is to think immediately, partly as defense and partly as for positivity, what are the opportunities which come from this? And was it the best thing that ever happened to me? Possibly, because it emancipated me. And emancipation and freedom and self-determination, I think for me and indeed for humans generally, is really, really important.
And probably galvanize you to set up Arlington on the site of the Caprice and Park and now
Simpsons. And Simpsons, I'm sort of quoted as saying it's the apotheosis of my career. I don't want it to be the end of my career. It's 25 years in the making. I first put a bid in 25 years ago, and then in 2008, and then in 2015, and even this time round, I bid on it in 2022, so it's 4 years in the making. And I sometimes forget just how great it is. Now I can see how good it is. Although I was indebted to a friend, a hotelier, restaurateur friend, who I took around and I thought wasn't enjoying it. And I'm not sure if I'm allowed. I never swear myself, but I do quote people.
You're allowed to swear on radio, yes.
And it got to the end, I thought, oh God, he doesn't like it, he's right, oh, what am I doing, etc. And he turned around and looked at me and said, Jeremy, this is fucking fantastic. Fucking fantastic. And I thought, yeah, he's right. It is. And sometimes we just need... I used to tell a story about the need in life. I played golf occasionally and I was in Thailand. And I turned up and there were two caddies for each of the players. And so one was carrying the bag and we were going, I didn't understand this. And then there was a little bit of an incline on the golf course and suddenly I found a hand and the small of my back pushing me up the hill, and it was the second female caddy. And I thought, we often need a Thai caddy in life. Just a reassuring hand on the back pushing us along.
Very good. And the last question might be a boring one for you, which is your favourite restaurant ever, and actually you do describe it. It's not actually a restaurant, it's a farmhouse in the middle of rural France. And why was that so fantastic?
I think it embodied... one of the great things about that restaurant experience is the fact that it was actually closed on the day. And we had the restaurateurs and ourselves, we had a mutual friend in Paris, and they said, no, we're closed, but join us for family lunch. And not only was the food fantastic, and yes, the rosé probably would never taste as good in London as it tasted there and the elements of it, but it was the generosity, it was the hospitality, and everything about it. And as the Mistral suddenly kicked up a bit and came in, and there was that sort of postprandial relaxation, I thought, this is sublime. Yes, if you say, where are you going to go for your last meal in London? It has to be the River Cafe. My favourite restaurants in the world were the old days of the grill room at the Seagram Tower, the Four Seasons, and those sort of places. But often, whilst I've had the Rob Lechon all-white truffle menu from back in the 90s, I think I don't really remember it. I think we all remember often the simplest of experiences.
Well, that's a very good place to stop. And thanks so much to Jeremy King for talking about his terrific book, Without Reservation. Thank you.
You have been listening to Radio Aldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Aldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.